A really cool material on the new floor of Fior that Lifra found. I couldn't help arching a brow when I heard that. What's the material? According to the system identification, osmosis stone. It can adapt to and accept the properties of nearby materials. We'll need to test how it works, but right now, it's surrounded by black stone walls. My eyes went wide at that implication. Those walls were the most durable material in the world. In fact, it was to the degree that the system labeled them as indestructible and impervious to any energy. However, I calmed down after a few moments. If they obtained the full properties of the black stone walls, we won't be able to forge them into anything. We'll be lucky if we can even mine out a few chunks. Well, I've got Lifra on the job. She should be able to get results sooner or later, though we won't be able to reach the 61st floor for quite a while. I arched my brow when I heard that. Admittedly, we had been making fantastic progress, but if Aravi was saying that, there must be some major obstacle. When I asked, she explained the layout of the floor to me, and I let out a long sigh. Sure enough, there was painfully little that could be done to resolve this situation, aside from waiting for them to luckily hit the jackpot. I got it. Let me know if they get lucky. At the very least, it sounds like the floor is safe once the new system is installed.
That's right, Aravi agreed readily. The only real problem is level of gravity, and we have ways of dealing with that. The total circumference of the floor is nearly a light year, so that's a lot of space that we can safely inhabit once the gravity wards are up. I let out a soft sigh, nodding my head. At the very least, this was additional space that we could evacuate people to, if it looks like we can't hold out for the invasion, especially given that the walls were significant enough to block out void travel. Though, that also meant that it would block out other means of void portals, such as network cables or the void core powering Olympus. For the network cables, they would need permanently active gates, but there was simply no way around the fact that Olympus wouldn't be able to exist on the floor. I thanked Aravi for the update and reminded her to first send any new plugins for her world through Ashley. In order to make it easier, I expanded everyone's territory to include Ashley's testbed world. That way, there was less of a risk of new systems causing a clash that could potentially crash the entire world. That would be bad. It would be very, very bad. Chapter 17. A blonde human woman with shining blue eyes stood before the great ocean of the 59th floor of Fior. In one hand, she held a gilded spear with a blue crystal head, her body adorned with golden armor.
Since it looks like the 60th floor isn't going to be available for habitation any time soon, we had best make use of this one as much as we can, she thought to herself.
Behind her, a large group of humans, halflings, and Dova all stood, anxiously awaiting the woman's order. However, she simply closed her eyes, letting her senses sweep out. This was the single largest ocean of Fior, its depths reaching more than 1 billion kilometers. Had she only been focusing on worlds such as Earth or Deccan, this astronomical number would seem nothing short of ridiculous. The idea that entire planets could easily fit within a single ocean was mind-boggling. However, it was true. The largest monster recorded within this ocean had reached more than 200,000 kilometers long. Although it wasn't quite large enough to consume an entire planet the size of Deccan, it was enough that its mere presence would be able to destroy the planet. Taking a deep breath, the woman stepped out onto the water, her feet forming ripples along the surface as she walked in long strides. Her figure blurred with every step she took, crossing hundreds of kilometers at a time.
We were always warned that physical planets were the easiest to destroy. That's why Aravi established Sanctum and its satellite worlds. However, Sanctum won't be able to withstand the coming invasion.
It didn't take long for her figure to escape the sight of those watching from the shore. But nobody made any move to follow or leave. They had been instructed to wait, so they would wait until such time as their instructions had changed. Behenna wanted an alternative to Sanctum, something that she could establish on Fior where there was no risk of void interference. In fact, she had considered the divine floor as a possible alternative, but chose to avoid it as the floor was still a material world. After a few minutes of walking, Behenna felt that she had come far enough, standing atop the ocean, land nowhere to be seen. Even the ceiling of this layer was too far to be discerned, the atmosphere itself forming a hazy blue barrier that resembled the daytime sky of other worlds. She held her spear forward, focusing her divinity. Runic markings began to light up the spear, and when she let it go, it began to hover in place. Behenna quickly reached into her inventory, producing a second spear. This one had a red spearhead, and she activated it just like the first. Then another, this one with a black spearhead. These three spears were set to float around Behenna, forming a triangle. When she clapped her hands, all three turned, their spearheads ringing as they struck the base of their neighbor, with Behenna standing in the center still.
"I can't just do this with divinity. I learned that from Aurevi. I haven't done as many big projects as her, but I can't afford that expenditure.
I am the one who quells the endless waves. My words dictate the flow of the world," Behenna began, a complex magic diagram expanding around her in a sphere. It had taken her years of study with Rion's incarnation to master this spell diagram. "Fire and stone as the heart, land and sea make way to the endless sky." As she spoke, the three spears began to separate, rotating around her as they pointed high above. "A world of boundless nature, yet untouched by the earth's pull. A home, a hearth, a hope, a land for those in need. Drift along the ocean's road to welcome lost travelers."
The spell diagram shrank and split, converging on each of the three spears. Immediately, they shot into the air, leaving blue, red, and black trails behind them. High above the ocean floor, within the empty sky, these three spears struck together. Boundless energy emerged from the world, green lights flowing from the air around them. When Behenna saw this, she stomped one foot onto the ocean, raising her hand to the sky. Streams of blue and gold power surged from the ocean beneath her, flying to join the slurry of energy being formed. Meanwhile, Behenna maintained absolute focus, watching as the energy condensed more and more, becoming a solid mass more than 150,000 kilometers across. She had considered making a planet within the sky, but it would be far too disorienting for anyone on its southern hemisphere to look up and see the ground above. Instead, she made an island. This island was only as wide as Deccan's diameter, and so it had less total land mass. However, this was an island made of pure energy, one which passively sustained itself by drawing on ambient mana and natural energy. Behenna created mountains and forests and channels for rivers to flow through. The entire process of the flying island's creation took only an hour, at which point Behenna called out, "Group one, take flight." Her words echoed in the air, traveling beyond the horizon to reach those that were waiting at the shore. A small number of those waiting flew into the arrow, turning into streams of light that shot towards the new island. These would be the first colonists, those setting up the initial infrastructure to allow for others to inhabit the island. Behenna let out a low sigh, checking her inventory, as well as her remaining mana. "Good. Still have plenty to continue." She had been preparing for this plan ever since she learned of the next invasion. Whether it was learning the necessary spell or stocking up on materials, she had filled her inventory with Mage Heart, as well as identical copies of the three spears. A blue spearhead to be the focus of her divinity, allowing the island to drift in the sky and harness ambient energy. A red one to form the core of fire and stone to create the landmass itself. A black one to create a localized gravity field, enabling even low-level civilians to safely inhabit them. Behenna began to walk again, moving more than 300,000 kilometers away. Then she once again started to pull the three spears from her inventory. "I am the one who quells the endless waves," she began, while thinking to herself, "One down, 49 to go."
"Lifra, wait up!" Petra called out in a panic, as Lifra jumped through a stone wall, hurrying to chase after her before the portal closed. "If the portal closes before I get through, I won't be able to find you again."
"Pfft, it's fine," Lifra shouted back when Petra barely made it through.
No longer was she covered in her armor. Instead, she wore a brown leather jacket and dark blue undershirt with brown cloth pants. She carried a pickaxe over her shoulder, the head engraved with runic markings.
"I've got the layout of this place tucked away up here," she tapped on her head with her free hand, causing Petra's eyes to widen.
"You memorized the layout of the floor? But we haven't even gotten to the spire yet."
"No big deal. Aurevi showed me a map while we went to relay the news."
Lifra puffed out her chest proudly, Petra blinking in confusion.
"You memorized a map that big from a single glance?"
Well, part of it. I got the gist of it, anyways."
Lifra turned her head to the side.
"Besides, this is a safe floor. The interference of the black stone walls isn't just preventing void fluctuations. Any airborne energy is dispersed. See?"
Lifra flicked her wrist, shooting out a basic fireball spell. Although the magic condensed, it fizzled away only a few inches after it took flight.
"Keep your mini-map up. The only way we can map this place out is with the system."
Petra bit her lower lip when she heard that. In fact, she had already noticed something similar before. When she mapped out the world with her world shadow, the shadow world created was blurred. Even now, it hadn't settled, and Petra wondered if it ever would. At the very least, it had registered as part of their shadow world, so they could grab the next floor whenever they opened the way. While Petra was thinking about that, she barely noticed Lifra jumping through another gate. Gasping, she chased after her.
"After saying all that, you're still running off on your own?"
Lifra let out a light, carefree laugh.
"We have a new fast travel. It'll be fine."
The other side of this gate showed one of the elevated islands, Lifra having to walk more than 100 meters to reach the end of it.
"Huh. I wonder how these are being held up."
"There are probably branches of black stone connected to each one," Petra speculated, seeing Lifra lifting up her pickaxe.
"Wait, don't tell me you want to..." "You've got wings," Lifra grinned, crazily, channeling her mana into the pickaxe and striking the floor beneath her.
The runic markings lit up, amplifying the force of her strike and spreading cracks throughout the island. Petra gulped, looking left and right quickly. Yes, she had wings, but a demon's wings were far from enough to let someone fly with the gravity of the 60th floor of Fior. She could spread her wings as wide as she wanted, and she would still plummet like a stone. She tried to condense darkness beneath her feet to stand on as the stone of the island fell away. Unfortunately for her, the energy put into the platform dissipated only seconds later. Just enough time for her to see that she wasn't entirely wrong. The island had been attached to a branch of black stone. Of a sort. However, rather than a thin branch like one might imagine, it was more like a wide platform, which they were now falling towards.
"Lifra!" Petra called out, eyes wide.
Given the distance between the two of them, there was no way that they would activate the same portal. However, Lifra was laughing as happily as ever, even as she was swallowed up by a gate. Petra soon entered one of her own, finding that her downward momentum had suddenly turned horizontal, launching her out of a wall. By the time she looked down, she saw that she must have been thousands of kilometers in the air. She shot out a burst of energy, propelling herself to the opposing wall and into another portal. Immediately afterwards, Petra grunted, falling to the floor in a pitch-black cave. As a demon and the goddess of shadow, it only took a moment for her eyes to adjust.
"Come on, Lifra,"
Petra muttered to herself, knowing that there was no way that Lifra was close by.
You know not just to smack everything you see by now. I know that you were told that this floor's safe and everything. With a sigh, she dusted her red legs off and pushed herself to a standing position.
At her height, her horns were already brushing against the top of the cave, showing just how small it was. Still, she walked forward, eyes roaming over the walls. There were dark crystals jutting out here and there, and she dislodged one to store in her inventory. Further down the cave, unwilling to release any of her power after knowing that it would just fade away after leaving her body, she would need to conserve her energy, or else take the gate back to the 59th floor.
Huh? Petra blinked, seeing something jutting out of the ground not far away.
It looked like a polished metal handle.
There is no life on this floor. How could there be a manufactured item? She asked herself.
She reached forward, briefly tapping the handle with a finger, just to see if it was going to do anything like absorb her energy. Seeing that it was safe, she grabbed the handle and exerted enough strength to pull it out. Petra's eyes widened at the sight before her. A black axe that only just barely fit in this cave. While not identical to her currently favored weapon, it strongly reminded her of one that she wielded for quite a long time in the past.
But how are you here?
She asked, thinking that she needed to take this back to Sora to study. As soon as that thought crossed her mind, the axe seemed to melt, reshaping into the form of a human woman sitting on the floor, her hand outstretched to be held in Petra's. Although she was made entirely of a black material, Petra immediately recognized the statue as one of her best friends.
It responds to thoughts? Memories? This is not what they mean by memory alloy, okay?
Chapter 18. After a few minutes, Petra had managed to control the new material well enough that she turned it into a bracelet resting on her wrist. Afterwards, she rushed to the black wall. Focusing, she sensed Lifra's presence through the party system. Lifra wasn't at any of the points that Petra had already explored, so she jumped into the gate and appeared at a random location. Finding herself even further from Lifra, she tried again, determined to try 5 times to get close to Lifra before leaving to report this to the others. Given that Lifra seemed to be stationary, she was likely mining. Unfortunately, even with 5 attempts, she was unable to come close to Lifra.
Well, that's not entirely true. She was able to luckily arrive only 1 wall away from Lifra at one point, but could not find the path to get around that wall.
Gritting her teeth, she sent Lifra a private message, saying that she found a new material and was sending it back to Thelsa. She couldn't be sure if the message went through or not, given the interference of the black stone walls, and could only leave through the gates. With the previous incident making them more cautious, Thelsa was now stationed just outside of the gate leading to the 60th floor, prepared to take action if there was another call for help. When Petra appeared through the gate, Thelsa's eyes went wide, and she stepped forward.
"Is everything all right?"
Petra had a conflicted look on her face, but nodded her head.
"I got separated from Lifra. It looks like she went mining. I ended up in a cave and found some materials that I want you to have a look at."
First, Petra pulled the dark crystal out from her inventory. When Thelsa saw this crystal, she furrowed her brow, not sure what to make of it. She could sense a faint energy from it, but could not immediately tell what it was for.
"I'll send this to the forging division. Anything else?"
Petra nodded, holding up her wrist. The bracelet she was wearing immediately turned into a giant war axe, startling Thelsa.
"This was in the same cave. It looks like it responds to the thoughts of the nearest being."
Thelsa's eyes widened, holding her hands out. Petra then turned the giant axe into the size of a small stone, passing it to Thelsa. Petra could tell that the material didn't change its weight, no matter what form or size it took. When the stone was passed to Thelsa, it immediately shifted to become a thick book, the pages made of black stone. Clearly, this wasn't the same black stone that made up the gates between worlds. In fact, Thelsa could confirm that the item in her hand wasn't able to reproduce any of the enchantments of the items it copied. Thelsa nodded her head, looking from Petra to the new object that she had been handed.
"I'll take these to be studied. Let me know if you find anything else," she said, before disappearing into the shadows.
Lifra hummed happily to herself as she swung her pickaxe, shattering stone with every swing. To her, it didn't matter all that much that she and Petra had been separated. Now that they knew that the floor was safe, it would be better to split up and cover more ground. Maybe that way they could find even more cool treasures. With that thought in mind, Lifra ran through gate after gate, until she found a large mountain within a vast clearing of the maze. Seeing that as an ideal spot to mine, she dove in and got to work.
"Aravi said that there were precious materials on this floor. I wonder if I'll get lucky and find anything."
Given the nature of the floor, she could likely dismiss the idea that a plain crossing material such as tide stone would be present. This was perhaps the worst environment for those types of minerals. At the same time, basic iron or gold wouldn't have gotten Aravi's attention. In fact, Lifra never even received Petra's message about leaving when she found something. Had she known, she likely would have left right away to see what Petra had discovered. Thelsa brought the two materials obtained from Petra to a research facility set up within her shadow world. Given that she intended to train people in every profession, it was only natural that this included scholars and scientists. While she dare not say that her people were better at their jobs than those of the Ashtanu Research Foundation, they were competent at their job.
"Ah, Lady Whitefallow," the lead researcher spoke up when Thelsa appeared, offering a bright smile. "What brings you here today?"
Thelsa held out the stone in her hand, having reverted it from its previous book-like appearance, as well as the black crystal.
"I need you to examine these materials. They're from the 60th floor of Fior that Petra just unlocked."
The researcher opened his eyes wide, nodding his head as he adjusted his glasses.
"I see. I'll put them through the tests right away."
With that said, Thelsa watched the researcher take both of the items, briefly surprised when the small stone turned into a black stone replica of a microscope in his hand.
"Fascinating," he muttered,
quickly discovering the special trait of this material, focusing on returning it to its normal stone appearance. The first item that he tested was the black crystal, placing it within a large machine that examined it by firing lasers from two extending arms. The man watched, waiting for information to appear on the screen. It was common practice to use machinery to examine a new material first before activating an identification spell. After all, some materials had adverse reactions when magic was used on them. However, after waiting for more than half an hour, there was no data being displayed.
"Now, that's odd," he said,
before shutting off the machine.
"Is it absorbing the energy being fired at it without allowing any to escape?"
Without expecting an answer, he decided to move on to the magical appraisal. As such, he placed the crystal on a circular metal plate carved with runic engravings. With a brief surge of mana, the plate lit up with an intense glow, arcane runes hovering in the air. Again, the researcher waited, only to find that this identification process had also failed.
"This too? No, it's not absorbing. Is it disrupting?"
Having this theory in mind, his first instinct was to register it with the digital conversion system. However, if the information about it couldn't be scanned with any of his devices, it was unlikely that he could use a digital conversion scanner. Instead, he took the crystal over to a grinder, wanting to get a smaller sample. Perhaps if he could break off a small piece, he could ask someone to visit a game world through the void and obtain the file that way. The researcher pressed the crystal against the grinder, powering it up and watching the sparks fly. He had anticipated that it might have a remarkable durability, but it seemed entirely unfazed by the force trying to break it down. However, there was a change happening to the material over time. Rather than saying that the material was breaking, it was instead losing its crystalline sheen. Its outer texture became more coarse, gradually shifting from a crystal to a common black stone. Only when it had fully lost its luster did it break under the force of the grinder. Seeing this, the researcher's eyes were wide, a look of realization dawning on his face.
"Lena! Take the second sample to the infuser, and use the largest mage heart crystal we have."
Immediately, a female researcher came forward, taking the other stone that Thelsa had provided, and moving towards a machine containing two chambers. In one chamber, she put a large blue crystal, and in the other, she placed the black stone. Under the lead researcher's fervent gaze, she activated the machine, which extracted the power of the mage heart to inject into the stone. This was a common tool for recharging spent items or materials, but he hadn't expected to use it like this. He could see the mana being absorbed by the black stone, causing its color to slowly shift to a dark blue, turning lighter and lighter as the mage heart was spent. When it was done, the researcher had Lena use another mage heart without delay, and then another. After the third crystal, the black stone had changed to appear almost entirely like a mage heart crystal itself. The researcher stepped forward, opening the machine and retrieving the shining blue gem.
"I see. Fascinating."
Without another word, he rushed over to an adjacent machine, this one used to extract energy from an object. After placing the now blue gem inside of it, he activated the device. Blue gas rose from the gem, the mana being absorbed into the machine for processing. As it did, like before, the gem gradually lost its luster, turning into a murky blue stone. Only when no more mana could be extracted did the researcher deactivate the device and retrieve the stone.
"It absorbs energy that comes into contact with it, taking on special properties. However, when the energy is exhausted, it becomes capable of altering its shape?"
Thelsa furrowed her brows, having watched the entire process. She even saw the blue stone turning into a dagger in the man's hand.
"So, these are the same material?" she asked, looking back to the former crystal that she had brought, now laying discarded next to the grinder.
She was surprised to find that the broken fragments had shifted, becoming larger and taking shape similar to the mage heart that had been used to test the other item just now.
"That's right, Lady White Fallow," the researcher spoke in excitement. "After the energy is drained, the item will retain the color of the last energy that had been used for it. Perhaps it is a residual effect. Regardless, it is clear that this item manifests in two forms, one filled with energy, and the other when it is depleted.
That said, I am curious what made it so durable in its previous state," he muttered to himself, flipping the dagger between his fingers.
Thelsa had an opinion on that when she had heard the researcher's report.
"The 60th floor, where these are found, is filled with black stone gates."
The researcher let out a gasp.
"You mean that it could absorb the energy of the gates, thus obtaining their indestructible property? That is remarkable.
Though the fact that you found one that had not done so means that it likely takes a long time for the energy of the gates to permeate. Or perhaps this energy had been blocked by other crystals that had already been filled. I will need to conduct more tests, to be sure. Would it be possible to establish a research facility on that floor?"
Thelsa thought about it for a moment before shaking her head.
"Unfortunately, the massive number of gates disrupt any energy being used. Even the shadow world of the 60th floor can't fully condense, so it is impossible for me to construct a facility there."
I see, that would be the case."
The researcher let out a long sigh of resignation.
"In that case, I can only ask that the depleted sample be taken back and put under observation to determine the amount of time that it takes to fill with energy. If the depleted stone can be shaped prior to being filled and maintains this shape throughout the process, it may be possible to obtain theoretically indestructible items." Of course, even the researcher himself knew that this was unlikely.
In order to maintain the item's shape, it would need to be under observation throughout the entire process, and the one observing must not let it change. If the process was slow, such as taking years or longer, it would be completely infeasible to create a so-called indestructible item. Thelsa nodded her head, seeming even more cautious than the researcher. After all, the normal methods of overcoming the gravity of the floors would not work on the 60th floor. This meant that a true powerhouse would be needed to handle the observation.
While I'm gone, use the other material to experiment. I want to understand the limits of what this can do.
Chapter 19. After the initial findings from the test, Thelsa sent a report to Olympus, detailing what they had discovered. Once that report arrived, I naturally took a look at it, interested in seeing the material that Aurevi had told me about. The fact that it had two stages surprised me, as did its secondary ability. At first, I thought that this might be a new supermaterial, one that we needed to mass-produce in order to create powerful weapons and armors. However, after reading through the details of this new memory stone, as they were tentatively calling it, my thoughts began to change. Admittedly, there were many potential uses for this material, but if I were to classify it as a supermaterial, it would need to overwhelmingly surpass what was on the market in some way. Currently, this item had only three things going for it. First, it was naturally dense, due to being from the 60th floor of Fior. From what Thelsa's report showed, it had excellent defensive properties, even in its depleted form. As far as defenses go, however, it would only be roughly the equivalent of iron found on the same floor. Worse, even, given that the armor may accidentally change into another form if the person wearing it wasn't careful. Its second remarkable trait was its ability to replicate the power of other materials. However, in order to do this, that material had to release some form of energy, such as the weak ambient energy of the Blackstone Gates, or the mana from a mage heart. It might be able to replicate dimensium, but certainly not items like mithril or orichalcum, as these materials don't release any ambient energy. The final benefit of this energy was none other than its shape-shifting property. This, if nothing else, made it remarkable as a weapon. After all, if someone had mastered multiple fighting styles, they would be able to have any weapon that they wanted on command. Surely that would be more convenient than swapping items in your inventory in the middle of a battle. But did this make it worthy of being called a supermaterial? I didn't believe so, personally. At most, it was nice for those without exceptionally powerful artifacts already. Now, if there happened to be other qualities for this material that were undiscovered in the initial tests, I would happily revise my evaluation. This can't be all that Aurevi was excited about. I shook my head, certain that there was more left to find on the 60th floor. In fact, I was fully aware that even the Greater Pantheon, like her, were unable to fully appraise a material just from looking at it from the admin room. It would be different if I did so myself, using my keeper ability, but they didn't have such a benefit. Actually, that's not a terrible idea, I thought to myself, tilting my head slightly. In the past, I wouldn't even consider doing something like this, if for no other reason than the level restriction on Fior. But I fixed that problem a while ago, didn't I? It was no longer as much of a hassle, to the point where I needed a mortal escort. Besides, Aurevi had confirmed from the admin room that there were no signs of life, so it should be safe for me to visit. It might not strictly be training my combat abilities, but it would allow me to experience more of my world. Aurevi, please send me to the 59th floor's upper gate, I communicated to the halfling goddess. There was a moment of silence before the request was carried out. Golden mist wrapped around my body, transporting me to an area where I could feel a heavy weight pressing down against me. Without my keeper levels, it would be hard for me to move naturally in this gravity. Looking around, it seemed as though Thelsa hadn't returned yet after sending the report, as nobody was present. With a shrug of my shoulder, I placed my hand on the gate and passed through. When I emerged, I couldn't help but stare at the walls that ran high into the sky, beyond the limits of what I could see. I closed my eyes, recalling what I had heard about this floor, and allowed my world sight to extend outwards in an attempt to scan my surroundings. Unsurprisingly, I felt that my world sight was dissolved soon after leaving a 10-centimeter radius around my body. It was curious that this seemed so exact, but at the same time, I felt a powerful trace of mana in the air. Did I land close to the spire? I thought to myself, sensing which direction the mana seemed to be flowing. Without any hesitation, I treated the mana as a small stream, traveling up it to find its source. As I did, I realized something that had been bothering me since my arrival on this floor. If all energy is dissipated when airborne, how does this floor have a day and night cycle? Reasonably speaking, one of two things should happen. Either the mana that radiates from the central spire should disperse before it resonates with anything that could produce this light, or the light itself should be blocked by the walls of the maze. However, it is clearly daytime, despite this. Curious to uncover the truth, I sped up, practically teleporting thousands of kilometers at a time as I channeled chakra into my legs. Even so, it took me more than 10 minutes to follow the trace of mana back to its source, passing through dozens of different turns. When I arrived, I saw a great clearing, one that made the entrance to the maze look like an almost completely flat wall. If I didn't know that this clearing was just a small part of the world, I would have thought that this was the entrance to the other half of the world, similar to the 25th floor. Far ahead, at what I knew to be the center of the clearing, I could see the mana pillar rising high beyond the horizon. This time, when I released my world sight, there was nothing interfering. As long as I did not try to send it back into the maze, I could explore this clearing as much as I wished. Thus, the first thing that I did was send my world sight up into the sky above me, beyond the limits of my normal perception. I wanted to see exactly what was happening on the ceiling of this layer. Where did the light come from? What I found caused me to freeze in my steps, my eyes going wide. There were colorful veins of minerals flowing through the ceiling. Red, green, blue, yellow, white, all interwoven with one another in various shades. Whenever certain shades of the red and blue mineral veins overlapped, it produced a field of perpetual flame beneath that crossing. It was these intersections that created the illusion of daytime, due to more than a tenth of the layer's ceiling being covered in flame. However, I couldn't help but pause and think, why are there so many dimensional minerals here? This would be the last place that I expected to find them. I even thought back to Aravi's claim that there was no life in this layer. With all of these here, how could nothing come through? The intersection of the mana stone and the fire stone even caused an automatic reaction such as this. Couldn't creatures pass through the opening? In my mind, these concerns were justified. All of these minerals would make this floor a natural destination for anyone passing through them. I pushed my world sight into the activated fire stone, studying its structure and attempting to infiltrate it. Once again, my eyes went wide. The connection between the Firestone and Mana Stone didn't cause it to be permanently opened, as I had initially believed. Instead, the connection was opening and closing at a rapid pace, more than hundreds of times per second. I focused, entering battle mode, to accelerate my processing speed to the limit, and then attempted to take advantage of this opening. With my level and stats, this tiniest fraction of a second could be stretched out enough to get a good look at the situation on the other side. To my surprise, though, the moment I slipped my world sight through the gap, it instantly closed ahead of schedule. So that's it. It's not opening on a timed schedule. It's forcibly closed as soon as enough energy passes through, and then immediately afterwards, the mana stone forces it to open again. That would explain the lack of anything coming through, as nothing was able to fit.
though it made me question why the connection was so unstable even in this clearing. Thankfully, my own energy wasn't disrupted in this space, so I directly teleported to one of the intersections, planning to take a look at it myself. As I had speculated earlier, I should be able to use my Keeper power to analyze the materials. Firestone. Mutated. Damaged. A dimensional mineral connected to the local elemental realm of fire. However, after being subjected to irregular energy over millions of years, the connection has become unstable. My brow furrowed when I read this information. If it were the stones inside the maze, I would understand the irregular energy. However, the energy of the black stone gates didn't touch this area, did they? Wait. I turned to look at the distant crystal pillar, feeling as if things were starting to make sense. During the day cycle, mana was constantly being released into the atmosphere. This mana pushed back the energy of the gates, creating this buffer zone. Then, during the night cycle, the mana would be pulled back in, and this place would become a dead zone for energy, just like in the rest of the maze. It's possible that the crystal itself is the reason why the clearing exists, the stone walls unable to grow near it. If that's the case, can intense mana interfere with the black stone walls? That shouldn't be possible, right? I felt the rather urgent need to test this theory. If it were true, then didn't that mean that the walls were not as safe as we believed? However, just as I began to channel my mana, I heard Rian's voice in my ear. "It's fine," she said in a playful tone. "I've already experimented with these gates and mana." I let out a long sigh, pulling back my mana. "So, were there any results?" "The gates were completely immutable," she reported with a slight huff, clearly unhappy with her own test. "Even when I used my divinity to pour 500 million mana into a single point, all that I got was a frustrating mana siphon. My theory is that this is involved in the creation of the world. Most worlds, the planet, is created by a great collection of cosmic dust that comes together and condenses into the basic elements that the planet needs. In Fior, one of these basic elements produces the seed of the central pillar, which grows high into the sky. After it hits a certain distance, the pillar creates a protective shell by resonating with the void, imbuing it with the rules of transportation, gravity, and invulnerability. This becomes the black stone shell around each layer. However, due to the law of invulnerability, the spire would not be able to continue growing after creating the first shell. Thus, instead, it creates a gate to accommodate it. When the energy passes through the gate, it seeks out the area where its connection with the previous floor is the strongest, and begins growing again. The rule of gravity on the shell causes some of the materials that hadn't settled on the previous floor to rise up, creating the ceiling. This process repeats over and over again until the spire is unable to continue to grow. As for this floor, the reason why the walls rose up to form a maze should be because of these special stones. When the world was still in its growing phase, the veins of mana stones resonated with the pillar and caused more walls to form. The only reason they didn't form in this clearing was that the energy was too stable directly next to the crystal. My brow twitched when I heard Rian's explanation. "You put way too much thought into this, didn't you?" "It was bugging me, okay?" Rian huffed indignantly. "I can't help but want to study something when it annoys me like that." Chapter 20. Now that I was already here on the 60th layer, I decided that I should take my time and explore a little. Although I had found the secret of the day-night cycle on this floor, there was no telling whether or not there was still more to uncover. And, while I could do so from the admin room, it was undoubtedly better to explore personally. After all, it was truly hard to grasp the scale of the area without walking it myself, and it was far easier to miss minor details. That said, I teleported back to the ground, not wanting to waste extra energy on keeping myself airborne after I began to explore the maze. The worst-case scenario was the night cycle beginning,
at which point I would have no way to differentiate where the pitch-black walls were, and could be teleported around randomly without constantly expending energy. However, I did not think that would be an issue. From my observation of the mineral veins above, they likely kept the world in a perpetual state of daylight, which was incredibly helpful when it came to navigating the maze. The first thing that I did was walk directly into one of the walls, wanting to send myself further into the maze. Once I had done so, I had no idea where I was in relation to my earlier point. What I did know, however, was that it was raining heavily. The area that I had found seemed to have a large lake, with rivers flowing alongside a shore through the maze. My brow twitched as I was subjected to the downpour, but I carried on. The water must have been built up little by little over the years through the tidestone, so it would be strange if there weren't any rivers in the maze. I simply created an umbrella made of solidified divine energy to prevent it from being dissipated by the maze. The rain was intense. Every raindrop, propelled by the enhanced gravity of this floor, felt like a rifle bullet was being fired at me from above. Although my defenses were enough to withstand it, that didn't mean that it was pleasant. Out of curiosity, I followed along the flow of the river, listening to the sound of the rain around me. It didn't take me long to notice the first effects of being deeper in the maze. For one, it took more focus for me to maintain my umbrella. While not a critical demerit, it was certainly annoying. However, the key problem was that it interfered with all airborne energies, even those used as part of the world's system. For example, when I opened my inventory, I found that it seemed filled with static. My mini-map appeared fine, as it was just a visualization of what my senses had discovered. But display screens that projected in front of me had become more of an issue. My main concern, while I followed the path of the river, was what we would use this floor for in the future. So far, there wasn't anything valuable enough to commit a large-scale mining operation. With the gates dissolving any airborne energy or enchantments, it wouldn't be possible to turn it into a residential area either. It wasn't even a good place to fight, because most ranged attacks would fizzle out. I'm sure Tubrak could come here to study the gates more in depth, at least. That wouldn't be the first floor that we had to abandon for one reason or another. I would just have rather found something to make this floor more important for our future development. Dana hummed to herself as she sat in her office, working at her terminal. There was a screen projected in front of her, showcasing a large ship, as well as several spheres of different material. Whenever Dana reached out to grab one of those spheres, the material of whatever she touched next seemed to change. "Let's see. I think the circuits should all be finished now," she muttered to herself. After she learned about the Keeper's plan to speed the world along, Dana had the idea to write a program on her terminal that would run for the entirety of her absence, optimizing the divine circuitry that she wanted to create for the new starship. With a wave of her hand, the results of the program emerged on the screen. Decades of development had led to this point, with 9 nodes scattered throughout the ship, all connected to the captain's chair via a complex network of circuits. "This should be good," she grinned, playfully, hitting a button in the bottom corner of her screen. Within fragments of Acidia, the command and construction file was received, a swarm of robots flying to work while Dana thought to herself. "My familiar set up that machine empire. I might as well let myself get some benefits from it." Lifra grinned as she swung her pickaxe horizontally, shattering the last boulder that remained from her mountain. She had already acquired nearly a dozen shiny new gems that she wanted to have Tubrak appraise when she got back to Olympus. Turning around, she gazed at her handiwork, the crumpled heap that had once been a towering mountain. A grin covered her face as she looked up, before blinking. She had just turned her gaze skyward when she saw something that shouldn't have been in this world. "Since when does Fior have moons?" she asked herself. seeing a hazy white circle high in the sky. Her eyes were wide, staring at what looked to be a moon just at the edge of what she could see in the sky. Now, logically, she knew that this must be just a massive island attached to another branch of the Blackstone walls. After all, the higher up you went, the further apart the walls were, giving plenty of room for this apparent moon. But on the other hand, I'm going to be the first slime on the moon! Lifra's body began to distort and shift, metallic wings sprouting from her back, like that of a plane. When she brought her legs together, they combined to form a jet engine beneath her.
Pilot, you are go for liftoff in T-minus... Now!
She shouted, flame shooting out of the engine beneath her, launching her into the air while she held her hands high above. She could feel the wind crashing against her, forcing her to create a helmet surrounding her face.
Fior, we have liftoff!
She cried out in joy, pushing more and more of her energy into the flames to allow her to accelerate faster. As one might expect from a moon-like object, the trip to reach it was quite long. Even at Lifra's max speed, it took her more than an hour. Had she been able to teleport directly there, the trip would have been over instantly. But such was not an option to the excitable slime. Still, she was going dozens of times the speed of sound, the air cracking around her in a narrow cone.
Faster! Faster! Faster!
She pushed herself constantly, the distant object slowly getting bigger and bigger until, to her surprise, she saw that it really was free-floating at the edge of the visible atmosphere. There did not appear to be any black stone gate supporting this spherical rock. This discovery only made Lifra more and more excited, her speed finally reducing when she felt a new pull of gravity grabbing her. Her eyes widened, letting herself fall towards this moon with a squeal of utter joy. The jet-like components sank into her body, and she rolled herself into a ball, crashing into the moon with a splat. After a few moments, the slime began to reassemble, forming a grinning Lifra.
One small step for slime, one giant leap from Fior's surface, she said, before breaking out in an almost hysterical laugh.
That was terrible, Aurevie replied with a mental groan,
though Lifra ignored her criticism. She jumped to her feet, observing the moon that she was now standing on.
How does it fly? If I push it hard enough, will it bounce off one of the walls?
Lifra asked, determined to get to the bottom of this in a way that only she could. In other words, through sheer and utter recklessness. She looked at her pickaxe, and then at the moon below her, realizing that this was certainly not going to be enough to mine out her new goal. So instead, she stored her pickaxe in her inventory, extending her arms out to her sides. Her hands began to glow, each one forming twin drills that began to rotate with a loud hum. Her legs thickened, clamps extending from near her feet to lock her to the ground.
Lifra, what are you going to do if your drilling breaks whatever is keeping the moon in the air?
Lifra tilted her head, giving that a serious thought. She ran through numerous simulations in her mind before reaching a brilliant conclusion.
I'll plummet to the ground and be buried in the moon.
The diameter of the moon is larger than the space between the walls at ground level, so the force of its fall will cause it to crumble around me, encasing me in a mountain of stone. Despite saying that, the drills actually became bigger. She moved her arms, shoving the drills into the ground to begin scattering rocks. To handle the overflowing rubble that was bound to pile up, Lifra made an avatar, whose own arms turned into a wheelbarrow and began collecting any rocks she didn't immediately shove into her inventory. Seeing her continue on, even after the warning, Aurevie's voice became helpless.
Then, shouldn't you be a bit more careful about this?
Oh, I'm being totally careful, Lifra refuted aloud, a yellow hard hat appearing on her head. See? Safety first.
After saying that, she pressed down, her drill hands allowing her to progress nearly a dozen meters a second. Every step she took was anchored, and her avatar was rushing back and forth to clear the way.
At her current speed and given the size of the moon, it would take her roughly an hour and a half to reach the moon's core. Of course, that was without taking into consideration.
Ooh, shiny!
Lifra's drills temporarily paused when she found a glowing red gem, taking a moment to carve it out for her inventory. Having to make such frequent stops like this, it was no wonder that the duration of her mining activity took nearly twice as long as she had initially expected. It wasn't until sparks flew from her drills and she felt the pain of hitting something far too dense that she knew she had reached her destination.
Okay, final stop, the core of the moon. All slimes, please leave the elevator to inspect your prize.
She grinned, reaching down to look at the black rock that had been revealed. For a moment, she tilted her head, thinking that this might be a black stone gate that had somehow not been connected to the rest of the walls. She reached in to touch it, seeing if the portal would open, but only felt a cool sensation against her fingers.
Okay, not a gate.
With that revelation, Lifra immediately began digging out around the core, wanting to see just how large it was. Digging in a circle around the core allowed her to realize that the black core had a radius of roughly 100 meters.
Oh, this reminds me of that material in Deccan. You know, the one with the flying islands?
Magnartum, Aurevi reminded, seeming distracted.
And somewhat, though this is far more dense.
At its size and weight, there's no reason that it should be able to float like this. Lifra's eyes practically shone as she heard that.
Well, it's not unbreakable like the black stone gates, although my drills can't easily dig it up. I made scratches.
This time Lifra did pull her pickaxe out of her inventory, as it was better to use for breaking dense targets than her drill arms.
I'ma smash it!
Lifra, no! No smash! Aurevi's voice was startled as Lifra raised the pickaxe.
Lifra, smash! She said,
before slamming the pickaxe down on the black core. Immediately a dense crack formed, which spread like spider webs throughout the core. The moon around her shuddered, and Lifra blinked. Suddenly the core erupted, shrapnel flying in every direction and shredding holes through both the surface of the moon, and more importantly, Lifra herself.
Ow!
Lifra whined, as she began to feel a sense of weightlessness, looking down at her body that looked as if it were being held together with dozens of thin threads.
Aurevi! Why didn't you stop me?
Lifra? Just pull yourself back together and get out before the moon lands. Chapter 21. Thankfully, it wasn't that hard for Lifra to escape the moon before it crashed down to the ground. Even with how fast it was falling in this layer's enhanced gravity, it would take quite some time, more than an hour, before it hit the floor. Once Lifra had pulled herself together, she had Aurevi guide her to where some of the shrapnel had fallen, and then finally jumped out to use the gate and leave. It was only a few minutes later when she was rushing through Tubrok's palace, heading for his private workshop. As she barged in, the dwarven craftsman glanced back, briefly pausing his hammering on a large sheet of metal.
"Oi! What are you doing here, lass?" he asked in a gruff tone.
Lifra simply grinned, running over to an empty workbench.
"I brought you presents from Fjor!"
she exclaimed, opening her inventory and starting to dump out all of the different materials that she had gathered. Tubrok's brow twitched, forced to just stand there and watch. He had heard about the new floor of Fjor and the mysterious memory mineral that had been found, but it was clear that Lifra had gathered more than just that.
"Did you mine out a whole mountain or something?"
"And a moon,"
Lifra nodded her head, causing the dwarf to open his eyes a bit wider.
"Since when does Fjor have moons?"
"Well, it had one. It broke down after I mined out its core, though. Oh, speaking of which, these were a part of its core."
Lifra grabbed two of the black shards from her inventory, pulling them out at the same time. The moment her hands were both out of her inventory, her eyes went wide. Her arms flew out from her body to either side,
colliding against the far walls while still holding the fragmented stones. Tubrok's brow twitched once more, looking at the arms that had been completely pulled off of Lifra's body.
"You'd best consider yourself lucky to be born a slime," he said, in a serious tone.
"I've always loved being a slime. It's so much more convenient than being a fleshy meat person."
Lifra nodded seriously, growing out two new arms. Tubrok waved a hand, exerting the power of his divinity to grab the two stones that seemed to be repelling one another.
"That must be how the moon came to be," he muttered,
feeling just how much force the stones were exerting on one another.
"They're like super magnets, right?"
Lifra exclaimed, happily.
"Oh, but they're not magnetic, and magnets can't just fly like that. Magical magnets. Magic nets? Maginets? I'll let you figure out the name for them."
Tubrok shook his head, doing his best to tune out the energetic slime girl. One of his abilities using a combination of the Forge and Innovation domains was to analyze materials and find places where they would fit in modern technology.
"If this can be controlled, it could perhaps be used to make some flying cars."
He then began applying ki, mana, even spiritual and natural energy to one of the pebbles to see if he could reverse its polarity and draw in the other stone. Unfortunately, there seemed to be no convenient method of doing that.
"Far as most tech goes, this is basically trash," he said in a harsh tone.
"Gah!"
Lifra flinched, shocked to hear that something she thought was so cool would be worthless.
I mean, it can't be all bad, right?"
"Maybe. Oh, maybe you grind it up and lace arrowheads with it and put some on a bow. Then it'd make the arrows fly out super fast, right?" Tubrok glanced at her pitifully before shaking her head.
"If that becomes the mainstream, all anybody would need to do to avoid an archer is to carry a small chunk of this. Any arrow laced with the stuff would avoid them, no matter how good the archer."
Lifra flinched again when her idea was refuted.
"Well, this created a whole moon. Couldn't we use it to make flying islands?"
Tubrok arched his brow, before deciding to give a demonstration.
"By my guess, there must have been another vein of the shite directly beneath the moon."
As he said that, he pinched one of the fragments between his fingers, slowly relaxing his power on the other to let it move more than a meter away. Afterwards, he slightly turned the piece he had pinched, and the other shard flew through the air.
"These pieces will always try to maintain a constant distance and alignment with each other. The only reason it made a moon was that this pair was properly aligned."
Lifra pursed her lips before her eyes went wide.
"It was able to create a localized gravity field that could even counter Fjord's intense pull. It sucked me in while I was flying to it."
That caused Tubrok to blink, looking down at the shard in his hand again. He could sense a very faint gravitational pull from the shard, but it was only slightly more than that of a normal object of this density.
"It must be exponentially strong as the size increases."
Tubrok offered a small nod at that.
"If you can get large enough pieces, as well as the paired veins to go with them, you could create a dwarf planet."
"Isn't that what Lorik's for?"
Lifra blinked, only for Tubrok's eyes to twitch.
"Not what I meant."
Looking at the various news coming in from different sources, such as Astanu's research lab, or even Thelsa's reports on the new minerals, I had the feeling that it was time to fast forward again. We still had a long way to go in terms of developing void defenses, and I wanted to skip ahead to a point where James would be back in action. Thus, I sent a message to everyone with access to Heaven's Gate, letting them know my plan. Even if they didn't immediately ascend, they'd be there shortly after. This time, Tsubaki made it clear that she would be coming with me. With a flash of light, I ascended to the admin room once again, preparing the alarms for when I would want to end this acceleration. While I was setting everything up, I heard the door open behind me and glanced back to see Tsubaki emerging. "Greetings, my keeper." "Glad to have you here, Tsubaki," I smiled. "Never feels the same when you're not around." She seemed pleased by that, given how her tails were swishing behind her. Shortly afterwards, Gerard appeared, as did Dana. The others, such as Julia and Asnod, seemed intent on remaining in the world, so I didn't bother them. "I doubt I could pull Lifra from a few decades of adventures anyways," I shook my head with a faint chuckle, before issuing the command to accelerate time. It had been more than 8 years since the 60th floor of Fior was discovered, and there was still no progress in moving to the next floor. They had even created a brand new job to fill this gap, known as the Gatekeepers. The Gatekeepers were individuals capable of resisting Fior's intense gravity on their own, and their only job was to explore Fior's 60th floor by constantly refreshing the gates. Regardless of whether they managed to find the passage to the 61st floor, they would be paid for their time according to their level. This was a rather popular job among those older adventurers that were on the verge of retiring, because this allowed them to earn money with essentially no risk. The Adventurers Guild had even created a special tool that would download an individual's mini-map and add it to a growing database. By comparing all of the map information that they had received over these 8 years, they believed that they had explored roughly 10% of the floor. 10% was by no means a small amount, given the total size of the 60th floor, but it was also a rather disappointing estimate. Given that they had thousands of people covering the ground by randomly teleporting hundreds of times per day, one significant change was brought about by the new transmorphic stone that could only be produced on this floor. Due to its unique ability, these stones are regularly mined and broken down to minuscule pebbles. These pebbles are then retextured by infusing them with dimensium and draining them to turn them silver, and sold to households as convenience items. After all, whether it is a cooking utensil, tools, or even toys for children, these stones are able to take any form that the user is familiar with. Another remarkable ore found in this floor was one that, when smelted down into refined metal, became a room-temperature superconductor. This sparked a mining frenzy within the 60th floor, as many technology companies sought to obtain samples of this material. From that moment on, technology began to advance by leaps and bounds, with formerly bulky machines becoming far more streamlined. Even the perfection chambers or divine forges within various facilities were remodeled, becoming little more than a small closet for one to walk into. Unfortunately, even as the years passed, there seemed to be no sign of progress in Fior's exploration. As time went on, the Ashtanu Research Institute seemed to become less and less influential after the departure of their lead researcher. While the Foundation's research was no less impressive, the problem came from its competitors. Those who had always sought to undermine the Institute for their own progress suddenly found themselves becoming more and more successful as time went by. After more than a decade passed, tensions were climbing within the research facility. For fear of the entire lab spontaneously exploding, they were unable to even mention the name of their former boss. For the first time since the Institute's founding, people began to resign. Although it was only two resignations, it was a significant event in the history of this Institute. When she saw her former colleagues leaving, Tracia couldn't help but grit her teeth in frustration. The two of them had always contributed to the research project, but very rarely offered groundbreaking help. Among the two, only 350 from the March was truly extraordinary due to his natural information processing speed. "It'll be fine," Chelsea said, as she walked up patting Tracia's arm. "If they want to leave, they can go." "But just because we're under new management, they couldn't hold on any more?" Tracia complained, still unable to say how they were waiting for James to return. Chelsea nodded her head, a somewhat cold smile on her face, once she knew that the two were well out of earshot. "Like I said, it's fine. Even if they've forgotten, Do you think the world will forget that those two are James's students? She asked, saying his name for the first time in years. Tracia's eyes widened, momentarily thinking that James must have resolved his problems if Chelsea was willing to say his name again. However, after thinking about it, her brow twitched. A small smirk rose over her face, and she nodded her head.
Yes, they are his students, after all, she agreed, confirming Chelsea's words. Even the other researchers had been forced to suppress this identity of theirs for nearly a decade, seeming to forget that this was why they joined the Institute in the first place. Without knowing why, the two departing researchers suddenly felt their backs becoming cold. A sensation of looming dread filled them, and they began to wonder if it was truly a good idea to leave as they had. Although their stress had risen over the last decade due to the almost oppressive atmosphere of the lab, they had forgotten just how vengeful Chelsea could truly be when it came to James. With just a few words, she had sentenced them to share in a mere fraction of James's fate. Chapter 22. By the time the fast forward had stopped, I found that 20 years had passed within the world. The first thing that I checked was to see if James had finished severing his karma yet, only to find that he was still out.